We ask about solar projects in Wisconsin and how they will weather soaring inflation and material shortages. It's the morning show. Glad to have you here. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This comes as utilities are partnering with companies that want to bring more renewables to the grid to achieve net zero carbon emissions by 2050. That's in line with the goal of the Evers administration. Join in on solar farms in your area, your residential rooftop solar arrays as well. Takeaways, what to know, 800-642-1234. Michael Vickerman is Policy Director for Renew Wisconsin. That nonprofit focuses on policies and programs that expand solar and wind power, biogas, hydropower, heat pumps, and electric vehicles. Michael, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. So what are you hearing? How delayed are the utilities in Wisconsin with their solar projects at the moment due to the economic headwinds here?
Thank you. So, yes, a couple weeks ago, several Wisconsin utilities announced delays in the construction of several solar farms, which received approval from the Public Service Commission. About a half dozen or so are affected by what you call the economic headwinds, principally bottlenecks in shipping and logistics, and more recently, the effects of a federal trade investigation over the sourcing of solar panels coming from Southeast Asia. It's a measure of how global the solar marketplace is, including the equipment sourcing and manufacturing, that 80% of the solar panels that are imported to the United States come from four Southeast Asian countries: Cambodia, Vietnam, Thailand, and Malaysia. And the investigation, for a while at least, basically stanched the flow of solar panels from those countries into the United States. Now, in the last month, the Biden administration stepped in and announced that there would not be any punitive tariffs assessed on any panels that come from those four countries, at least for the next 2 years. So we may see some movement again, but there have been COVID-related constraints and bottlenecks elsewhere in the overall manufacturing, shipping, delivery, and construction of these projects. And it looks like that at least a half a dozen of these projects are going to be delayed 12 to 18 months from their original projected start date.
Okay, so that's pretty considerable. And last year was a very good one for the solar expansion, for solar projects. What does that mean for the growth of solar in our state and the growth of solar farms?
Well, I tend to look at this situation more as a hiccup than a malady or something that requires more more intervention on the part of policymakers. If the trade investigation concludes by the end of August that there was no illegal trade practices occurring, that would go a long way towards smoothing out the supply chain. It has to be remembered, though, that and this is true with many other industries, that the way the solar market is organized, it depends on a nearly constant demand and throughput of materials. And if there are any disruptions, perturbations in that flow, it can back things up a long time. We have as well, not just simply material shortages, but also labor shortages. Mm. Most of the contractors that I spoke with at the energy fair 2 weeks ago said that they're the biggest problem that they see for themselves and is meeting the demand for work with more installers, more people on the ground or on the rooftops, installing systems for customers.
I'm going to pause here and reintroduce you, Michael Vickerman, Policy Director of Renew Wisconsin, as we talk about solar power in Wisconsin, the global supply chain disruptions that he sees. You can join in on solar and your experience as perhaps you get residential solar installed this summer. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Michael, you said there that, you know, these projects really depend on a smooth throughput of material. And we've seen in other industries where, you know, chip shortages have really upended supply chains to delivering vehicles, for instance. Is there something specific here in the materials being used that are just not coming through for solar arrays and these solar projects?
Well, the thing that makes solar power go are the panels themselves. Mm. And it's that particular component that has been the most disrupted. You did mention inflationary pressures across the spectrum, and that's had an effect too, although less so with solar power than with other industries. I mean, there's a fair amount of steel that goes into a solar farm. Let's not forget, when I say solar farm, I'm talking about a power plant here. Mm-hmm. And so that contributes to the cost of the project, but it contributes to the cost of everything that's built with steel. And so all other kinds of power plants would be affected too, as well as other items that require steel. The situation is we're not used to seeing these kind of disruptions and inflationary pressures with in the solar market for years and years and years. The price trend has been downward, but it appears we've hit rock bottom. There's been a spike in the last 2 years, principally caused by COVID-related constraints. Basically the shutdown of manufacturing in parts of China. Mm-hmm. But we also see signs that it's slowly working through. And another point I would like to make is that the constraints have affected the larger projects, the solar power plants, if you will, more so than the smaller scale solar installations, which would include small solar farms and what we call rooftop solar,
yeah,
or customer-sided solar.
That's what I wanted to ask you there. I mean, how are these challenges and market delays affecting residential rooftop solar projects?
At this point, not significantly.
Okay.
In fact, it certainly hasn't affected demand for rooftop solar. If anything, that's increasing. There have been spot shortages here and there of various components, but not to the same extent that we're seeing with the larger projects.
Michael Vickerman heads up policy for Renew Wisconsin as we get an update on solar power projects in our state and what these economic headwinds mean for the timeline and goals set for reducing carbon emissions. Join in on the cost, the projects, how you see solar in Wisconsin's future energy mix, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show. Michael Vickerman here on the Ideas Network. Checking in on challenges facing solar projects in our state here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Alliant Energy set to begin construction on 6 new solar projects in central Wisconsin. One example of a project in the works. There is a pending solar boom in Rust Belt states. That's according to S&P Global Market Intelligence. Its report released Wednesday said six states, including Wisconsin, have recorded increasingly ambitious solar pipelines, and they credit corporate interest on renewables. Join in on the pipeline for solar, how you see it, 800-642-1234. Michael Vickerman is Policy Director of Renew Wisconsin with us for about nine more minutes. Michael, you really brought us into the global scope right away to this conversation, and acknowledging Cambodia and Malaysia, Thailand, Vietnam, producing really about 80% of solar panels imported by the U.S. Last month, President Biden waiving tariffs on U.S. solar imports from all four countries. What does this change in terms of cost and supply cost?
That's a good question, and I don't know if I have a completely settled answer for that. My response would be that solar power will always, if the inflationary pressures that we're seeing elsewhere will be understated with solar, that solar will become even more of a bargain in the future relative to other energy sources than what is the case today. I want to call attention to the fact that the principal energy source for electric generation in the United States now is natural gas in most parts of the country. And natural gas's share of the generation mix is increasing, including in the state of Wisconsin. And the price of gas has more than doubled in the last 12 months. And this is largely attributable to the fact that U.S. Gas producers are now serving a global marketplace. It's suddenly the number of customers out there has increased by a couple orders of magnitude as gas is being shipped to Europe, Asia, and other distant markets. And that is the principal inflationary driving force in the generation of electricity today. Coming back to solar, it's important to remember that the fuel is free. Inflationary pressures can affect the price of steel, or the cost of labor in the construction of a solar project, but the fuel itself will always remain free. And so with that, and that's also true with wind power and hydropower, that salient fact will put solar power in a very strong competitive position going forward.
What is the situation with the debate over whether third-party financing is legal under state law? What's going on there?
Very, very good question. Wisconsin is one of maybe 20 states that either doesn't have a firm policy or bright line kind of policy on third-party financing of solar systems. Other states in the Midwest that allow that include Michigan and Illinois and Iowa. So what this means basically is that the system, the installation you put on your house or in your yard, in many states, it's okay if a third party owns it. Instead of yourself. Mm-hmm. The utilities in Wisconsin contend that the law requires the property owner to own the system. We don't see that in the law. So this is in the last month, a couple of petitions were submitted to the Public Service Commission, the regulatory agency here in Wisconsin, to review the law and to affirm that customers have an affirmative right to electricity produced for themselves from systems on their property, regardless of who owns them. So the debate hinges on the definition of a public utility, and it's our position that if you're building a system just for one person, or a group, a defined group of people on in one property, that does not make the owner of that solar system a public utility. And that's what the Public Service Commission will decide on, hopefully, later this fall. It's not, they haven't disclosed whether they're going to accept the petitions or not. We'll find out later this month whether whether that's the case, in which case this will become a very, very high profile issue.
I just want to jump in here because Republican State Senator Rob Coles of Green Bay, he had that bill last year clarifying third party financing. It didn't advance, but he said you can finance anything from a new water heater to energy efficient windows to help reduce your energy consumption. And he said there's no reason you shouldn't be able to do the same to generate your own electricity. So what do you think is holding the PSC back, the Public Service Commission back on this matter, or the legislature for that matter?
There have been several petitions submitted in the past, and they were rejected by the Public Service Commission. The commission of several years ago basically bought the utility position that any entity that sells or leases sells power or leases solar to a particular individual is a public utility. The utilities are basically circling the wagons around the imperative of protecting their generation monopolies. They're not happy when somebody else owns electric generation in the state. There is very little independently owned electric power plants in the state, and they're trying to extend that monopoly to include what goes on your rooftop or behind your meter. And we think that the law does not support the utility monopoly that deep into a customer's space. So we have an opportunity with the last time this petition this type of petition was brought forward to the commission, it was tabled on a one-to-one vote. This time around, if the commission accepts these positions, there will be three commissioners voting on the matter instead of two.
Wait to be seen. Michael Vickerman, who is policy director of Renew Wisconsin, talking about solar power infrastructure, the situation in the economy, and other issues around solar. 800-642-1234 to join in. We heard from Weldon in Fountain City, called, couldn't stay with us. Weldon wants to know, what is the future of net metering for rooftop solar? In Wisconsin, I understand, mandates net metering. So when solar customers produce more energy than they use with their panels, they sell the excess back for a credit on their energy bills. But I hear, and I think this is the but, energy companies aren't required to buy back your electricity at the retail rate. Is that right?
Mostly correct.
Mostly. Okay. Carry on.
Net metering is an important policy mechanism for small customers who have invested in solar power basically to serve themselves. But there will be times when the electricity produced by that solar system won't be completely absorbed by all the appliances and other electricity using devices in the house. Some of that flows into the grid. And what we have in Wisconsin is a patchwork series of net metering tariffs, very utility specific. They have different thresholds for how large the system can be before it's no longer eligible for net metering. There are different procedures for calculating the net. There really is no overarching policy in the state of Wisconsin. And utilities elsewhere in the country, at least some of them, have been pushing back on net metering, trying to reduce the price paid for any electricity that's exported onto their grid. Michigan now has no net metering, and we certainly don't want that to happen in Wisconsin. So right now, the Public Service Commission is looking at this issue, and either later this year or early next year, it's probably going to take another step that will engage the public in defining what sort of net metering practices we'll have for the future.
We only have a few seconds left, Michael, but of all the variables that you have just talked about, what is the most pressing thing that you're watching in the coming months?
One that we haven't talked about yet, federal tax credits.
26%.
It's 26% now. It'll drop to 22% next year, and it'll drop to zero for residential customers and beginning in 2024, and only 10% for commercial customers. There's an effort underway to extend the tax credits. It requires congressional approval. Right now, negotiations are underway between the White House, Senate Democrats, and particularly Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. It's really important that the current tax credit structure is maintained.
Michael, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Michael Vickerman, Policy Director of Renew Wisconsin. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about the power of preparing a good meal.
Writer Crystal Chan loves to cook. During the pandemic, she traveled home often, enjoying long stays with her parents. To show her gratitude, she would cook delicious and comforting dishes for family dinner. She shares a story celebrating the labor of love that goes into making a great pot of stew.
A little while ago, when I was visiting my parents in Wisconsin, I found an old cookbook that I had purchased in France. I've been visiting my parents as an extended guest throughout COVID, journeying back and forth between Oshkosh and Chicago. Gratefully, my parents welcomed my ping-ponging across the state line with open arms. Come, stay as long as you'd like. Leave whenever you wish. I love cooking, and I quickly found that making home-cooked meals for my parents elicited oohs and ahs, and my stepdad's famous understated way of declaring that he loved a dish. He would say, "I could eat that again." Cooking was a very excellent way to express my gratitude. So, I took that French cookbook and found a recipe for beef bourguignon. The next day, I made the pot of deep simmering broth, rich chunks of beef and vegetables and wine. My parents exclaimed how I was filling up the whole house with such rich smells. There is something indeed really special about filling up the house with a loving smell of simmering food. I am a foodie for sure, and I have found that it's a very sensual way of taking up all the space in the house. You put love into a pot, add a gentle flame, and then surrender to the process of transformation. And somehow, it fills up the whole house, this energetic field of nourishment and love of which I am a critical part. I love the meditation of cooking. You transform one thing into another. You take multiple ingredients, and somehow they turn into a unity that perhaps an onion and a carrot could not have otherwise imagined. Then, if you are lucky, you can share such love food with beloveds, and the deep aromas of stews that will linger in the house long after the meal is over. That's how love works. This resonance gently permeates, so that the moment you open the front door, it greets you. Love, savory and nourishing, caressing you all, both unseen and everywhere. After hours of simmering, I declared that the meal was ready. My stepdad had set the table hours before in his wordless display of anticipation, so I poured the glasses of wine, reverently placed the food on the plates, and granted them to my parents with a flourish. To our stunned delight, my stepdad took his time eating. Usually, he inhales his food. Now he savored it, feeling the flavors in his mouth, tasting the thyme and the deep love it rested upon. My mom excitedly asked me questions about the recipe, the process. I told her what I could about the recipe, but the process? That's harder because it includes unnameable steps. Feeling into the timing of the food, knowing the exact moment the next step needs to begin, and infusing the recipe with love. Finally, as we sat back in our chairs, hands on our contented stomachs, my stepdad looked at me with sparkling eyes and said in his ritual exclamation, "I could eat that again."
Writer Crystal Chan brought you that story about the power of preparing a good meal. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
And now to a lab at UW-Stout and their intensive care work, as they put it, to revive and bring back lakes from the dead, one Wisconsin lake at a time. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. One big problem is excessive phosphorus runoff and algal blooms. Join in on lake health and how you work to improve the lake ecosystem. 800-642-1234. Bill James is here, Senior Researcher, Director of UW-Stout Center for Limnological Research and Rehabilitation, also known as CLEAR. Retired senior lecturer at UW-Stout, more than 30 years, was a research aquatic biologist with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Research and Development Center. Bill, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate.
Good morning. Your center has been treating lakes now for over a decade, and you'll start rehabbing again this summer in Polk County. Can you walk us through some steps? How does CLEAR begin its rehab?
Sure. I think it all starts with diagnosis. We have to understand where the phosphorus is coming from. Is it coming from the watershed? Or is it coming from internal sources, the sediment that's stored in the lake? So we actually monitor lakes. We go out every 2 weeks and collect samples for phosphorus and other variables. And we put a picture together with this data. And then that way we can understand what to manage. Do we manage the watershed, sources coming off the watershed, or do we manage the sediment that's stored in a lake?
Phosphorus, though, is essential for plant life, an essential nutrient for algae and aquatic plants. When does phosphorus then become bad for the water body, bad for the lake?
Yes, this is a great question. A lot of our lakes, just about all of our lakes in Wisconsin and Minnesota came from the glaciated period 10,000 years ago. There was very little runoff. These were pretty pristine watersheds with forests and prairies. Humans came along and we started clearing the land. Agricultural production started to fertilize the land, especially in the 30s and 40s. This sort of resulted in runoff. We didn't have that structure there to keep the soil in place. So over the past 50 to 70 years, soil that has been enriched in phosphorus has run off into our lakes. And this becomes stored in lakes. Recently, we've become really good at trying to prevent this runoff, but the sediment that's been stored for the past 70 years is coming back to haunt us. It's becoming recycled and moving back up into the water, and the algae can now take this phosphorus up, even though we may have reduced watershed inputs, and it can still use that phosphorus for growth. So we're finding that we have these horrendous algal blooms. You know, these nuisance algal blooms. Our lakes are pea green in the summer.
And they're toxic.
And they can be toxic as well. It's really become a serious problem.
Well, Wisconsin has thousands of lakes, and I know better than to throw out a number because that can get prickly depending on your criteria of what is a lake. But how do you choose which lakes to work on?
Well, that we at CLEAR are an outreach center. So we developed the center lake districts, cities, counties, government agencies can contact us. And that's really where the process begins. And then we work with lake districts and governments to try to diagnose the problem and come up with a solution.
How long does that plan take? How long does it take to bring back a lake, to restore the balance?
Yes, it's quite an involved process. And in particular, we work with the DNR. They provide lake planning grants that can be used to fund studies to diagnose lake problems. And once that's accomplished, we need a proof of concept. We need to know that what we're going to do, what we're going to manage, has a reasonable expectation of success. Because often lake management is millions of dollars, and it's very long term. Aquatic ecosystems are very complex. It is the most complex unit of nature. And it's difficult to manage. It's difficult to push these lakes back into a better state, reverse what I call eutrophication or over-fertilization. So a process can take years to a decade or more. It's an ongoing process.
Are these long-term lake treatment plan prescriptions, if you will, are they purely chemical in nature, or are there other components in the rehab?
Well, we at CLEAR specifically work on lakes that have this internal phosphorus recycling issue. And this is very common. Under these conditions, this is mainly a chemical treatment. There are a lot of options out there. I specifically work using a chemical called aluminum sulfate, or alum. And, you know, alum is really, it's a common a compound. Many of us have it in our spice racks in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And it just so happens that alum can react with water to form aluminum hydroxide. And it's very inert, but it can act as a magnet to attract this phosphorus that's in the sediment and keep it in the sediment, keep it from becoming recycled. This is very similar to rust. You know, iron hydroxide is rust. Aluminum hydroxide is very similar.
We have the leader of UW-Stout Center for Limnological Research and Rehabilitation. Bill James is here. His team travels around the state and Minnesota to clean up waters. Join in on this work of treating, reversing damage to lakes. What is happening on your lake? 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show. Back in a minute with Bill James here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about long-term treatments for Wisconsin lakes, how to improve water quality so that lakes can be viable for recreation. The DNR says it's unable to test all reported blue-green algae blooms and to treat them with caution, as in stay out of the water when you spot them. Join in on lake water quality treatment approaches, 800-642-1234. Bill James is a senior researcher and director of UW Stout's Center for Limnological Research and Rehabilitation, goes by CLEAR, with us for about 9 more minutes. Bill, we were talking about alum there, and the criticism is that it's a short-term fix to a long-term problem, that if people don't change their ways in protecting the watershed, that, you know, you can't just rely on this fix forever.
Right, right. That's why it's very important to look at the overall picture. We have to understand that we have to change our behaviors. We have to reduce what we do on the land that promotes this runoff and phosphorus sedimentation in lakes. So it's very comprehensive. Once we do that, though, these in-lake fixes do become important, and then they can become long-term success stories. Hmm. Once we reduce watershed inputs, if we can bind that phosphorus in the sediment and keep it there, we can shift the lake to a clear water state and we can keep it there. So that's the key, just this overall comprehensive stewardship of a lake.
Let's do this moment for a case study. Half Moon Lake in Polk County, prior to the treatment, this was a murky, smelly, too green for swimming recreational uses. Now, water clarity is 5 feet deep, and you're going to be treating the lake again this summer. What happened to this lake?
Yes, there must be about 5 Half Moon Lakes in the state of Wisconsin. This one's actually in Eau Claire, and it's an oxbow lake. It's right in the center of town. It's just had a history of abuse. About 100 years ago, during the peak of the logging industry, they used to shovel horse manure out on the ice in the winter and let it melt. Let the ice melt and this phosphorus input settle into the lake. You know, they did this for decades. And this came back to haunt the city. It just had terrible algal blooms. And it also had invasive aquatic plants. Recreation was impaired. A beautiful swimming beach couldn't be used. Boating was difficult, imagine rowing through the weeds and that sort of thing. So this again was a huge process. It really started back in the 90s. The lake was diagnosed. We understood what the problems were and began to change behaviors and treat the lake. The first alum treatment was over 10 years ago, we continue to beat back that internal phosphorus recycling. The idea is to apply this at a low dose, but over a period of years, and this just action just slowly binds the phosphorus and keeps it in the sediment. And here we are, I think it's like 4 treatments later this year, and the lake is just responding so well. The beaches are being used again. Events are coming back. they have the Eau Claire Triathlon. You know, the first leg of swimming in Half Moon Lake. I mean, that's just been a huge success.
That's a landmark, sure. A landmark moment of being able to use a lake again. I want to ask you, I mean, you use the word beat back in terms of working with this phosphorus, this legacy phosphorus, if you will. But we're also trying to beat back invasive plants and invasive species like zebra mussels. What is the impact of those invasives on rehabbing a lake?
Right. Well, especially with shallow lakes, aquatic plants can be really invasive. We have a lot of aquatic plants that have been derived from Europe and Asia. Curly leaf pondweed is an amazing and invasive. It's very adaptive. It can just dominate a lake. It was brought over 100 years ago. And we've actually had to deal with that on Half Moon Lakes, as well as many other lakes in the state. And we do have treatments for that too. We use low dose herbicide treatments. And that sort of cuts into the life cycle of the plant. And what we're trying to do is prevent its successful reproduction. And we've been doing that on Half Moon Lake for over 10 years, and it's really, really been successful. We hardly have any curly leaf pondweed anymore. Zebra mussels, you're right. That's another big issue with our inland lakes. They're really starting to invade. You know, at first glance, they filter the water. They filter algae.
Mm-hmm.
But they do so selectively. They sort of promote cyanobacteria or blue-green algal growth, because blue-green algae, they're not palatable. You know, if a zebra mussel has a choice, they'd rather eat the more delicious diatoms and green algae, and they leave the cyanobacteria or the blue-green algae.
Picky.
Yeah.
Well, we are almost out of time, Bill, and I'm just wondering, do you have any tips or one tip in particular to help reduce phosphorus if you have a nearby lake or if you're a resident on a lake?
Yes, I think the most important thing is creating buffers between the shoreline and the property owner. A buffer can prevent runoff from the property. It can create habitat for plants and animals. It's a great stewardship thing to do.
Bill, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Bill James, Senior Researcher, Director of UW-Stout's Center for Limnological Research and Rehabilitation. We have a link at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.